This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In the region, of course, it is a major setback for Iran and Hezbollah, its client. And it's a setback for Russia. The two main supporters of the Assad regime no longer have a regime to support.
That's Ambassador Ryan Crocker, a former U.S. ambassador to Syria, on the end of over 50 years of Assad family dominance in Syria. Details coming up also. The International Rescue Committee says Sudan has become the biggest humanitarian crisis ever recorded. And Nigeria steps up the fight against gender-based violence. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. VOA's Jackson Mfunganye interviewed Ambassador Ryan Crocker, a former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan, about the situation in Syria. Ambassador Crocker discusses the current state of affairs, and he emphasizes the importance of international engagement and collaboration with regional allies to foster stability and security in Syria.
I think it's a time of jubilation, clearly, for many in Syria. A brutal regime is swept away, but it's also a time of concern for many, particularly minority groups like Christians, Alawis, and Kurds. The Assad regime, itself a minority of the Alawi sect, tended to protect other minorities, and with a Sunni majoritarian movement now leading this revolution, I think there are concerns on the parts of those minorities as to what happens. In the region, of course, it is a major setback for Iran and Hezbollah, its client, and it's a setback for Russia. The two main supporters of the Assad regime no longer have a regime to support. That is, in many respects, good news, I think, for regional stability. But it is also, again, a time of uncertainty. We don't know much about Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, that is led by Abu Muhammad al-Julani, formerly an al-Qaeda affiliate, that has since publicly split with al-Qaeda. But who are they? Are they a fundamentally, philosophically, and ideologically different organization? Or is it sort of al-Qaeda light? All to be determined. And most fundamentally, I think, there is the question of what happens next. Can those who led the revolution to topple the old regime now consolidate power, which in many respects is a bigger challenge than the overthrow of the regime in the first place? And that remains an open question. What I can say with a fair degree of certainty is what I don't think is going to happen. I don't think you're going to see a rules-based democratic order emerge based on respected institutions anytime soon in Syria. For over a half a century of Assad rule and for decades before that, there was no emphasis on a legal foundation that protected all its citizens and provided security for all of its citizens, that provided government services, that provided economic opportunity. Syria does not have a history of that, and that lack of a history, I think, sadly dictates that it is not likely to have these attributes of a modern nation that serves its people anytime in the near future.
Syria has suffered massive destruction and a humanitarian crisis after this decade-long conflict. What would you say are the immediate and long-term needs for reconstruction, and how should they be approached?
Well, the most immediate need is for wide-scale humanitarian assistance. The Syrian economy was already in ruins even before this latest phase of the war, and that revolution has swept away even the wholly inadequate institutions that did exist under the Assad regime. So the first imperative, I think, for the international community is to do everything that we can do to alleviate the suffering of millions of Syrians who have already suffered so much under the brutal Assad regime and the subsequent civil war. The primary vehicle for that assistance is the United Nations, and it deserves our wholehearted support in making available and coordinating humanitarian assistance. Beyond that immediate human need, whatever can be done to stabilize the security situation in Syria is imperative, recognizing that this has to be done from within Syria. It can't be an outside imposed order. That's one thing I think we learned in Iraq. So I think engaging this new emergent movement, HTS, and its allies, identifying who they are, seeking to understand their agenda, and sending the message that international recognition and support will be contingent on how they conduct themselves in these critical early days and weeks.
That's VOA's Jackson Mfungane talking about the Syrian situation with former ambassador to Syria, Ryan Crocker. A new report by the International Rescue Committee says Sudan has become the biggest humanitarian crisis ever recorded after 20 months of devastating war between rival generals. The French news agency AFP reports that the group's 2025 emergency watch list says that the country accounts for 10% of all people in humanitarian need, despite being home to less than 1% of the global population. Since April 2023, a war between the Sudanese regular army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed tens of thousands of people and uprooted 12 million. Nearly 9 million of those are displaced within Sudan, most in areas with decimated infrastructure, and they face the threat of mass starvation. The United Nations says that across the country, nearly 26 million people, around half the population, are facing acute hunger. In an attempt to end polarization in Zimbabwe's media, an organization is hosting sports events for journalists from the privately owned and state-run media. Columbus Mavunga joins the inaugural event in Harare, where he files this report.
These journalists usually compete against each other for breaking news, but today they face off on the soccer pitch in Harare. It is all part of a new initiative to end a polarized media environment. The Sports Day is set up by the non-profit Gender and Media Connect. Its national director, Patience Rima, says she hopes sporting events like this one will reduce media polarization in Zimbabwe and improve the wellness of reporters.
This day is going to be very critical because we've seen media houses from across the divide coming together to organize this event. And I think this is just a way that the media can now be able to really come together to network and to be able to find common ground as they do their work.
One of those involved is Leopold Munhende, a senior reporter for the media outlet New Zimbabwe and the president of the Young Journalists Association of Zimbabwe. Munhende says he sees the same news events being reported on in totally different ways. But he says coming together in a relaxed manner could help change that.
We get to meet as journalists from different sides of the of the media industry, the publicly owned and the privately owned. We get to discuss the articles which we are writing, which are causing a lot of discussion.
Godfrey Maregere from the state-owned Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, which is seen as supportive of the ruling ZANU-PF party, also thinks the games are a good idea.
The games help to bring about teamwork, regardless of who you work for as journalists, as one team. Even when we return to work, disagreements and looking down on others will get less. Regardless of gender, we can play in one team, be it netball or soccer.
Another benefit, say organizers, is that the sports will improve the health of those taking part and help them ease stress. The government-appointed Zimbabwe Media Commission has been calling for an end to media polarization for the benefit of audiences. Godwin Piri, its executive secretary, says there are ways media can improve the situation.
News refuse to be spokesperson for politicians. Speak for the profession. When you find yourself parroting a political position ahead of your journalistic principles, then you already have a problem.
Piri says that when reporting is polarized, the more likely it is that audiences and advertisers could be driven away, causing media outlets to close. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. We might air your comments on Africa News Tonight, and the number again is +1-202-258-3076. Nigerian authorities are seeking to launch a national action plan on gender-based violence, or GBV. Nigeria's lower house of parliament made the announcement as lawmakers joined activists for a rally to coincide with the annual world campaign known as 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, which ended yesterday. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Hundreds of people, including women's rights activists, Nigerian lawmakers, and other participants, chanted as they walked from the National Assembly through the streets of Abuja on Monday. The rally was part of Nigeria's participation in the United Nations-backed 16 Days of Activism campaign against gender-based violence, or GBV, running from November 25th to December the 10th. But it was also an opportunity to announce the latest efforts by authorities to address gender-based violence in Nigeria. Abbas Tajuddin, Nigeria's Speaker of the House of Representatives, led lawmakers to the rally. It took place on the 25th anniversary of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women.
For every 10 minutes, a woman is being killed across the world. This is an unacceptable trend. This is an unforgivable trend. We in the parliament must have to unite more than ever before with relevant authorities, particularly the law enforcement, in ensuring that we cut this dangerous trend to the barest minimum.
Gender-based violence is a global problem. Nigerian authorities say about one-third of women between 15 and 49 experiences physical and sexual assault in her lifetime. The country also accounts for approximately 20 million GBV survivors, or about 10% of the global total. Poor awareness, a low rate of reporting, cultural and religious biases, and trust deficits in the justice system are some of the challenges hampering efforts to address GBV in Nigeria. Raquel Kashem Daniel is the founder of the nonprofit Beyond the Classroom Foundation, which promotes the rights of girls through education and advocacy.
I think that policies that protect women and put, you know, perpetrators behind bars would be very helpful. One of the ones we're championing with is the Sexual Harassment Bill in tertiary education. That would be a very good one to pass. And we hope that it gets the presidential assent soon.
Nigeria had previously launched a sex offenders registry to name and shame perpetrators of violence against women. On Monday, Women Affairs Minister Imam Sulaiman Ibrahim announced the launch of a national electronic dashboard system to improve data collection and accountability. Sulaiman Ibrahim also said, besides preventive measures, authorities will review existing laws to ensure they protect survivors of gender-based violence.
This occasion provides us yet another opportunity to renew those commitments and take deliberate actions to protect the rights, safety, and dignity of women, girls, and vulnerable people across Nigeria.
As authorities continue to make efforts to address the problem, Many hope the new intervention offers a lifeline to millions of vulnerable people. Africa recorded the highest rates of intimate partner and family-related femicide last year, followed by the Americas and Oceania, according to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Somalian officials say that fighting erupted today between fighters in the semi-autonomous Jubaland region and federal government forces after Jubaland held an election against the advice of authorities in Mogadishu. Reuters News reports the clashes could raise concerns that internal rivalries are diverting attention from the fight against the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab group in Somalia, just as the mandate of an African Union peacekeeping force expires. The Assistant Security Minister of Jubaland, Adan Ahmed Haji, told journalists in the regional capital Kismayu that federal forces from Mogadishu in Ras Kamboni using drones attacked Jubaland forces. Somalia's defense minister said it was the Jubaland forces who attacked federal military troops that were deployed in Lower Juba to take bases formerly used by the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia. A federal army officer in Mogadishu said today's fighting was in about 20 kilometers from Ras Kamboni, a town where federal troops have increased their numbers since the election. At a landmark climate change hearing at the UN's top court, small island states argue that global warming poses an existential risk, so human rights laws should apply. Britain, echoing other big economies, countered that only existing international treaties should have relevance. As Henry Ridgewell reports, this case could reframe global climate change negotiations.
Some 99 countries are participating in the hearing at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands, making it the largest case in the court's history. It has pitted small island nations against big polluters and fossil fuel producers. At the heart of the case is whether international law obliges nation states to prevent climate change and pay for the damage caused by their greenhouse gas emissions. Britain on Tuesday argued that only existing climate treaties, such as the 2015 Paris Agreement, have any legal relevance. British Attorney General Richard Hermer.
The climate crisis can only be met by states working together. The most constructive, the most concrete, and thus the most legally effective way is through the legally binding agreements setting out states' obligations to tackle the challenges of climate change. And at the heart of this treaty framework, at the heart of the global response to climate change, is the landmark Paris Agreement.
Small island and coastal states argue climate change threatens their existence, and so international laws like human rights legislation must apply. Arnold Keel-Lockman is Vanuatu's Attorney General.
The conduct responsible for this existential harm cannot, and I repeat, cannot be lawful under international law.
The judge's advisory opinion has the potential to reframe climate change negotiations, analysts say. Elena Kozolapova is a senior policy advisor with the International Institute for Sustainable Development.
The expectation is for the court's advisory opinion to provide a clear legal benchmark and remove any ambiguity around countries' obligations under international law. And UN negotiations would certainly benefit from legal clarity.
Scientists say climate change is driving extreme weather events around the world. That has put the spotlight on the rights of the communities affected. The International Court of Justice is one of three international courts asked to provide legal clarity on climate change. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights held hearings this year in Brazil and Barbados and is expected to give its opinion on nation states' legal obligations in the coming weeks. Judges at the Hamburg, Germany-based International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea ruled in May that greenhouse gas emissions are subject to international law and that all states are obliged to limit global warming and protect marine environments. Judge Albert Hoffmann is president of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea.
If a state fails to comply with this obligation, international responsibility would be engaged for that state.
Small island states praised that opinion, claiming it gave teeth to climate change laws. The hearing at the International Court of Justice is due to finish on Friday. The judges are expected to take several more weeks to issue their advice. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Donald Trump has signaled he wants to avoid involvement in Syria following an insurgent group's ouster of President Bashar al-Assad. However, as White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wirakuswara reports, some regional experts say the president-elect might need to balance his stance with U.S. goals of protecting Israel, isolating Iran, and dealing with Russia, Turkey, and other actors.
Syrians are still celebrating the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad, who has fled to Moscow. But the country's future is far from clear as regional powers scramble to secure their interests. From the south, Israel launched strikes to weaken what's left of the Iranian allies' military. In the north, Turkish-backed rebels seized territory, causing Syrian Kurds to flee. U.S. President Joe Biden has moved quickly, launching airstrikes on Islamic State group targets in Syria.
The United States will work with our partners and the stakeholders in Syria to help them seize an opportunity to manage the risks.
By contrast, President-elect Donald Trump has signaled a more hands-off approach.
It certainly seems like the world is going a little crazy right now.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebels who toppled Assad, is a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist group. Still, Trump wants the U.S. to stay out of the Syrian conflict. This is not our fight, he said on social media. Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick for intelligence chief, agreed.
He is fully committed, as he has said over and over, to bringing about an end to wars, demonstrating peace through strength, and putting the national security interests and the safety, security, and freedom of the American people first and foremost.
But with Assad gone, Trump may need to balance his non-interventionist stance with U.S. goals of protecting allies such as Israel and Jordan and avoiding the resurgence of terrorist groups such as Islamic State. Christopher O'Leary focuses on counterterrorism at the Sufan Group via Skype.
Reducing the access to chemical weapons, reducing the capabilities of known terrorist organizations in ungoverned space or in space where there's failed states, where nobody else can do it, I think is a very smart move. And I do think that is likely what President Trump will continue to do.
During his first term, Trump ordered strikes on the Assad regime in response to chemical weapons attacks, but focused more on defeating Islamic State. He ordered U.S. troops out of Syria in 2019, leaving a few hundred American soldiers to protect oil fields. He was criticized for abandoning allies. Following the withdrawal, Turkey launched offensives against Kurdish forces who had fought alongside American soldiers to destroy Islamic State in Syria. This time, Trump said, quote, "Let it play out. Do not get involved." But with so many U.S. interests in the region, that may be easier said than done. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Tian Wong, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.